Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
It is Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
And I had a little bit of smoky barbecue crunchers still there. I was kind of grinding away on when I started talking.
Yeah, well, those are nasty.
Yeah, they're...
That's that diet stuff that Mary was getting. She doesn't get it anymore, but it some of it was just gross.
Yeah, they have an odd taste.
Yeah, you have to be desperate to eat that stuff.
I was pretty desperate. I'm pretty hungry.
That's why it's still left in the drawer. It's the stuff we couldn't tolerate.
Yeah, I went through the carb drawer to see what you had up there.
Yeah,
this was it.
Yeah, that wasn't a good choice.
There wasn't much in there, though. beggars can't be choosers or something. Beggars can't be picky or, I don't know. You know what I'm saying.
Yeah. And you know, the one thing that I forgot to mention last week in that episode is my favorite case is where the guy got up there to give his alibi and the judge just interrupted him and said, "UGLY, you ain't got no alibi, you ugly, you ugly." that's always bad when you present your alibi and that's what you get in response.
Yeah.
That shuts you down.
That's like a special jury instruction.
That's right.
If the jury will find that the defendant is ugly.
UGLY. He ain't got no alibi.
He will determine that, therefore, he does not have an alibi.
He ugly. Yeah, yeah. He ugly.
That reminds me of that movie Wildcats with Goldie Hawn.
Yeah.
That was with the cheerleaders. They did that cheer, I think, in that movie.
Did they?
Yeah. I have a lot of useless movie trivia knowledge. I don't.
You must. I don't remember anything. The movies I watched were back before I started my descent into old age, and I don't remember anything anymore. I mean, outside of Outlaw Josie Wales, that's about it. I might remember a title, but other than that, that's the only movie that I remember actual scenes and lines from.
That's the only movie in your database?
Yeah. None of the rest were worth keeping.
Everything else has been purged.
That was like Mary asked me the other day. She said, "How come you keep calling people by the wrong name? Why can't you remember their names?" And I said, "Look, I've got all the names in my head I can remember. If I'm going to remember one more, I got to drop one out. So it depends on who I'm going to forget so I can remember somebody new." Nobody new has made the grade.
You called Owen the wrong name at the beer fest.
Yeah, but
that might have been alcohol.
That was alcohol induced. And it was also, I started thinking about that. Why did I call him Phil? Well, there was a guy that I went to school with named Philip Owens.
Yeah.
And I think that I started calling him Owen. I'm thinking, oh, that's his last name in my inebriated state. That's his last name. And I said, Philip. And as soon as I said it, I was like, why did I call him Philip?
That ain't right.
Oh, well, sometimes, you know,
yeah,
it just catches up with you.
So you had an update, didn't you, from one of our previous episodes?
Yeah. It seems that the episode where we had that pedophile that has still not come to trial yet, it's been almost 20 years or whatever, that they were still trying to track him down. Supposedly he'd been hired to help a judge figure out if the prosecuting attorney had been hacking her computer and all this kind of stuff, and it ends up of course that DA, he filed so that she couldn't hear any more criminal cases that they had, because he didn't feel she was unbiased. And then now she has been indicted along with the three people, including the pedophile guy and two others, for tampering with county computers unauthorized. So
I was reading that article. Somebody posted it on our Twitter, and I think they had a special prosecutor come in too, like from the state. They didn't. The same prosecutor wasn't the one who indicted them.
Yeah, because the other guy's involved. He would have to recuse himself.
Yeah, anybody that works at that courthouse, that's a judge of that courthouse or prosecutor in that courthouse, can't really handle that.
Right, but there's something wrong there.
Something's up.
Yeah, that whole thing is a mess.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we even read when I looked up those things that there's a group within the county that's in charge of that. I forget, with the professional services or something like that. And that's who you go to with any irregularities. So you don't just go hire, you know, Joe Computer off the street to come in and do it and have access to the county's files and everything.
Well, he seemed like a good guy.
Yeah, he was wearing glasses that were taped together on the bridge of the nose, so I figured he had to be a smart computer nerd. That qualified him right there.
I had a slightly off-color joke that I'm not going to make. It's in reference to the Geek Squad, but
yeah,
and it also had to do with the charges that he was facing.
Oh.
Some other kind of squad.
So that's best left unsaid.
Probably so. Probably so. That's one thing doing a podcast has taught me. Some things are best left unsaid.
You? How about me? I get you sometimes look up from behind the microphone and just start shaking your head. And I'm like, uh-oh, what did I say? I don't even know what I said. You're going to have to edit that out. Wow, what was it?
Well, it's been an adventure.
Yeah. I've learned. I know you take longer in between your lines. Of course, I edit that out. But you take longer between yours. And I know that you're weighing them first to make sure. And I have trouble. I don't weigh my words too well. I just spit them out. And once they're out there, I go, oh, no. Did I say that out loud?
Yeah, I try to chew on it for a second and think about what I'm going to say.
I figure that's from your courtroom proceedings.
It probably is.
Because you probably want to take your time and say the right thing, not just anything.
Yeah, but sometimes you got to say just anything because taking your time and saying nothing is worse than just waiting. You're just, he didn't do it.
Now, while I'm thinking, let me perform a little soft shoe for you.
Yeah. Oh, my shoe's untied. Hold on 1 second. I've been down. Tie my shoe.
Time out.
That's why. It's
Judge, I need a time out.
It's always good to get a drink of water, take a nice pause.
Like, what's his name? That Florida Senator, Mark Rubio?
Yeah.
That was doing that rebuttal speech there several years back, and his mouth got so dry he couldn't even talk, and he had to stop right in the middle of it and chug like a whole glass of water.
That happens to me when I'm doing public speaking. If I eat something sweet,
yeah,
like I don't drink anything in my coffee anymore that's sweet, but I used to have cream and sugar, and if I had sugared coffee before court in the morning, and I tried to project my voice in a courtroom, I would dry up. And same thing, if I go to lunch and I have a hearing in the afternoon, and I have like a Coke or something like that, I lose my voice. Hmm. So I've learned that
you should drink water.
I just drink water.
Yeah, so that's what us thespians do before we go on stage. It's only water. You don't want to gum up the works.
Yeah. Does that really happen?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It'll ruin your instrument.
Will it?
Yeah. Hmm. I mean, not permanently, but just it'll be in there. It's just like there was a scene when I played Henry Higgins that I had to eat chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, do I really get to eat on stage? They were like, yeah. And I'm thinking, all right, I get to eat chocolate there while we're doing this. Well, I get there the first night that they have the actual props, and I go to eat it. I'm like, what the hell is this I'm eating? And the props lady had taken rye bread and rolled it up into balls to make it look like chocolate balls.
Right.
And that's what I said. I said, wait, where's the chocolate? You can't eat chocolate. She had an accent. She was from Germany, came over from Germany, and she still had a thick accent. Mm-hmm. And she was like, you can't eat chocolate on stage. It will ruin your throat. You must eat the bread. And I'm like, man, bread's no fun. I don't care. That's what you're getting. So that's what I got. I got rolled up rye bread for chocolate. I did not enjoy eating it.
Well, I understand it because it ruins my instrument.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that I had an instrument.
You have to keep your instrument clean.
Okay.
That's right.
So anyway,
I had a lady tell me once, she said, you know, you say that you're not a singer, but I think you have a beautiful instrument. I didn't know how to respond.
Thank you. So this episode was suggested by someone on our Facebook page, on the Court Appointed Facebook page. It was Haley Potter McDaniel.
Yeah. Oh, that's Harry's sister.
Yeah, maybe so.
She got married, thus the McDaniel.
And
Haley and Harry, they're twins.
She suggested a subject which we hadn't talked about before, but kind of we've talked about issues related to it before, but never actually this one theory.
And I've never even heard this theory before.
It's the eggshell plaintiff rule. And you never heard it before, huh?
Well, eggshell skull, it's also referred to, or the thin skull.
Yeah, well, and the reason it's for that is because an eggshell is traditionally very thin and able to be cracked, like Humpty Dumpty, who fell
right
off the wall.
And broke into all kinds of pieces, and they couldn't put him back together again.
No, not all the king's men, not all the king's horses, nobody.
He was scrambled.
So, I thought we'd go into the history of it a little bit, and what it is. So, basically, what it relates to is that if someone is injured in an accident and they have something that's already kind of wrong with them to begin with, which makes their damages worse, then whoever caused the negligence is going to be liable for that, that extra damage that was caused to them because of their certain state. So this theory was basically born in concept, but maybe not in name, back in 1891. There was a case by the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and it was called Vosburgh v. Putney. And there was a childhood altercation at school. A 12-year-old George Putney kicked 14-year-old Andrew Vosburgh in the shin in a classroom in Wisconsin. And unbeknownst to Putney, Vosburgh had injured his leg the month before in a sledding accident, and the kick aggravated the previous injury and eventually led to Vosburgh permanent incapacitation with that leg.
So, wow.
Yeah. So the way it basically took place was that it might not have held Putney liable if he had kicked him like on a playground off school while engaged in the usual boyish sports, it said.
Right.
Instead, doing so after class had been called to order by the teacher and after the regular exercises of the school had commenced. So it wasn't like they're on the playground playing. He was in the classroom and did it. So the court felt that was even more egregious.
So it wasn't in the course of normal duties.
Exactly.
In recess or whatever, you're used to kids kicking each other. Yeah. But in classroom, you're supposed to be a little more subdued.
What do you guys want to play today at recess? I don't know. Kick the shin? Okay. First.
I'm tired of kick the can. My butt hurts. That's like the guy that I had to go to testify at that he got sucker punched during a basketball game, a pickup basketball game.
Oh, yeah. I remember you telling me about that.
Yeah. And the judge said, well, do things ever get boisterous up there and people get hurt? Yeah, sure. People catch elbows, things like that. So he just said, it was just a rough house basketball game and let him go. No, it was a sucker punch. The guy waited there at half court, kind of with his back turned, and when the guy went running by, he turned around and just sucker punched him right in the jaw.
Yeah.
That's not even roughhouse basketball. That's just assault.
Yeah. That's what you go to court for.
But they let him off. They said, oh, it's just roughhouse basketball. Next.
So the court found Putney liable for all damages arising as a result of the kick, even though he did not intend the harm, nor was he aware of Vosburgh's previous injury. And according to the court, the wrongdoer is liable for all of the injuries resulting directly from the wrongful act, whether they could or could not have been foreseen by him. So that's the base. That's kind of the genesis of that theory. And about that same time, in a similar geographic area in Minnesota, a case decided 8 years after Vosburgh, a salesman sprained his ankle while exiting a train, and he developed inflammatory rheumatism because of the sprain and died from inflammation of the heart.
Inflammatory rheumatism?
Yeah. And the court concluded that the plaintiff's predisposition to rheumatism was immaterial and held the defendant liable, even though he could not have foreseen the particular results, which did in fact follow. So somebody sprains their ankle and then dies, and you're liable for it.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
but you have to have practiced some type of negligence.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was some negligence as to why he sprained his ankle.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there was a hole or something.
I mean, it can't just be they picked you out and blamed you, and so
yeah,
you're responsible.
So in 1901 is actually when you first start to see the term thin skull, and that was an English court, and they decided Delu versus White and Sons, and in Delu, a negligently driven horse van crashed into a pub. Sounds like tragedy.
Yeah, that was probably the Budweiser guys delivering their beer.
Clydesdale's?
Yeah.
And a pregnant woman was working behind the bar, suffered severe shock as a result of the crash, became seriously ill, and gave premature birth. The court awarded the woman damages, reasoning that is no answer to the sufferer's claim for damages that he would have suffered less injury or no injury at all if he had not had an unusually thin skull or an unusually weak heart. So the fact that, you know, she was pregnant, they basically had to take their plaintiff as they found her.
Mm-hmm.
So
take your victim as you find them.
Yep. And so the eggshell plaintiff rule basically developed into a doctrine by courts, and they started awarding damages in a variety of different pre-existing physical conditions. Jacob Stein notes these cases generally fall into four categories. First, courts apply the rule when defendants unearth a latent condition ailing plaintiffs. And by latent, we mean it's not obvious, it's hidden. Patent means it's out in the open. Latent means it's hidden. Like, mm-hmm. You always hear about latent fingerprints.
Right.
It means they're hidden fingerprints. Mm-hmm. So the example of that would be in the Reed versus Union Pacific Railroad Company. The plaintiff was injured when his truck hit an exposed replacement rail as he crossed the defendant's train tracks, aggravating an unknown pre-existing degenerative disc condition. The court held the plaintiff was entitled to a jury instruction on the eggshell plaintiff rule. The fact that his condition was previously unknown was of no consequence. So, second, the rule applies when a defendant's negligence reactivates a plaintiff's pre-existing condition that had subsided due to treatment. In Bruneau v. Quick, the plaintiff performed an operation on the plaintiff's feet, which worsened an existing foot condition that the plaintiff had struggled with her entire life. The defendant argued that his actions did not aggravate an unknown pre-existing condition. The court nonetheless concluded that the application of the eggshell plaintiff rule was appropriate and held the defendant liable for injuries that were different in degree because of the plaintiff's condition. So there's already a pre-existing condition, and you're trying to operate on it, and you make it worse, you can be liable for that. The third theory imposes liability on defendants if their actions aggravate known pre-existing conditions that have not yet received medical attention. So, for example, in Glomman v. Kirk, the defendant's car rear-ended the plaintiff's truck, resulting in severe headaches from whiplash and cervical spine injuries. The defendant argued that she should not be liable for the extent of the injuries on the theory that the plaintiff's headaches had been caused in part by a fractured jaw from a prior car accident. The Alaska Supreme Court rejected the argument and held the defendant liable for the full extent of the plaintiff's injuries. And the last one is the eggshell plaintiff applies when a tortfeasor accelerates an inevitable disability or loss of life due to a condition possessed by the plaintiff, even when the injury would have eventually occurred in the absence of the defendant's negligent conduct. So, McCahill v. New York Transportation Company, that case, the defendant's employees negligently drove a taxi and struck the plaintiff, who suffered from alcoholism. After sustaining various broken bones, the plaintiff died in the hospital from a condition associated with alcoholism. The court affirmed an award of additional damages, even though the plaintiff's alcoholism likely would have eventually resulted in his premature death. So, basically what landed him in that condition was essentially his own doing, but at the same time, it accelerated what was going to happen to him, so it didn't matter. So,
yeah, well, even if they already had this going on and it was going to, the guy only had a year to live.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. You still get treated the same as anybody else.
Right.
You take your victim as you find them. I think that's funny the way they do it. You're tortseer or whatever they call that.
So some interesting things to note about the eggshell plaintiff is that it extends to injuries that do not immediately manifest themselves at the time of the defendant's tortious action. So basically, if it happens later on, you can still be liable for it. And the defendant must be at fault for the eggshell plaintiff rule to apply in court to trigger the rule. The court must first conclude that the defendant breached a duty and the breach caused the plaintiff's harm. And lastly, the rule imposes liability even when the plaintiffs possess vulnerabilities of their own making, similar to what we just said about the alcoholism.
Yeah.
So some legal scholars have said that basically the eggshell plaintiff rule is essentially an extension of the foreseeability test, which does not require the extent of the injury to be foreseeable, only the type. Others look at the eggshell liability as an outright exception to the rule requiring foreseeability. So there's kind of a different way you can look at it there. The courts are usually candid in recognizing that unforeseen personal injuries are not subject to the general proximate cause rule that harm be foreseeable.
You know, but somewhere I was very disappointed in hearing these things, because it's somewhere along the line they didn't list whatever the first case was where this thing got its name. Because I imagine there was some case where there was some guy that was, you know, like the neighborhood bully or whatever, and he liked to walk up and he just whacked people in the back of the head. And it hurt, but, you know, it was more annoying than anything else. And then one day he walked up and whacked somebody in the back of the head like he always does, and this guy's skull caved in, and he either got brain damage or died or something like that. And they said, well, what happened? Well, he had an eggshell skull. Well, then it's not my fault. If he hadn't had an eggshell skull, it wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
Yes, it is your fault. So from then on, it was the eggshell skull theory. There had to be somewhere in there that happened that, you know, somebody just whacked somebody in the head. And just an ordinary whack that you do all the time, it wouldn't really matter. But this guy died.
Judge, it's not my client's fault. That guy was a real egghead.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, there are some modern interpretations of it where they're kind of extending it a little bit, and that's kind of controversial.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about that, but before we talk about that, I think we have a motion before the court today.
Why, yes, we do have a motion before the court. It's been a motionless court here for a while, but we do have one, and it's from our good friends at Sleep Number.
Now, I love Sleep Number. Let me tell you why. Getting a good night's rest is important. I am constantly on the go right now. In addition to work, I'm coaching soccer, doing a podcast, just staying busy.
Even playing soccer.
I am even playing soccer. You got to get that sleep.
That's right. Sleep is important. Because if you don't have sleep, then you're awake.
That's true.
Now, it's the 100th year of the NFL. Woohoo, the NFL. More than 1,800 NFL players are now sleeping on Sleep Number beds, improving their game with better sleep. And certainly, you don't think you're better than an NFL player. So, you know, it's good for them, then it's good for you.
I'm going to take the moral high ground here and say I am.
Oh, some of them.
Some of them.
At least Antonio Brown.
Hey, I got a beef with Antonio Brown. I don't want him tweeting at me. So, it is the smartest bed for better sleep. Sleep Number beds allow you to adjust on each side to your ideal firmness, comfort, and support.
The Sleep Number 360 smart bed senses your movements and automatically adjusts to keep you sleeping comfortably through the night. I saw that in action on TV on one of their commercials.
Did you?
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, you're just laying there sound asleep and the bed adjusts to you. You don't even have to do anything. It's like magic. It's just like Harry Potter.
With Sleep IQ technology inside the bed, it tracks how you're sleeping so you can know every morning how you slept, and it gains insights for your best sleep. That's magic.
Does it tell you how many calories you burned while sleeping?
Maybe.
Come in during the fall sale where a Queen Sleep Number 360 smart bed is now only $1,399.
Sleep Number is the official sleep and wellness partner of the NFL. You'll only find Sleep Number at one of their 600 Sleep Number stores nationwide. Find one near you at sleepnumber.com/court.
That's sleepnumber.com/court. Tell them Mike and Tommy sent you. Nighty night, little buckaroos.
So now, in recent decades, courts have extended the eggshell plaintiff rule to talk about psychological harms and economic injuries. So when it comes to psychological harm, plaintiffs in most jurisdictions may now invoke the eggshell plaintiff rule to recover for physical and emotional harms resulting from pre-existing psychological conditions. So there's a case called Bonner v. U.S., the court held the defendant liable for emotional injuries resulting from a car accident. In that case, the plaintiff became permanently disabled months after the initial accident. The treating physician found that the accident set in motion a series of events leading to psychiatric illness. After concluding that the accident was a cause and fact of the plaintiff's mental illness, the court held the defendant liable for the psychological harm. So courts have also employed the eggshell plaintiff rule to impose liability for economic harm resulting from the unforeseen or unknowable damage to property as well. Kind of interesting. You can expand it to psychological damages.
Well, there's a lot of legal scholars that are split on that, though, that don't believe that it should apply to that. So at some point, that will probably get challenged somewhere.
Oh, absolutely. There's
because the eggshell theory stuck strictly to physical damages.
And traditionally.
It had nothing to do with mental or financial ones. The financial ones would be more under the shabby millionaire, which is also another legal theory.
Yeah. You like that one. Why don't you tell everybody what that is?
Well, the shabby millionaire basically said that even though you do something that you know may have a consequence, but it incur something far beyond a financial consequence that you expected. Like, and the thing that they gave, well, here, I'll just, instead of me memorizing it, which I don't do very well, I read it out of here. It says, the shabby millionaire says, it's important to distinguish the thin skull problem from a closely related yet distinct principle, which may be called the true value or shabby millionaire rule. It said, it's like this. If a person fires across a road when it is dangerous to do so and kills a man who is in receipt of a large income, he will be liable for the whole damage, however great that may have resulted to his family, and cannot set up that he could not reasonably have expected to have injured anyone but a laborer. So in other words, the guy walking along looked like he just got off the construction job. He was in old dirty jeans and a ripped up t-shirt, and he was dirty and just shuffling along, and they shot him. Well, he's just a bum, isn't he? No, it ends up he's a millionaire.
Yeah.
So now you owe a lot more money because you caused a great economic harm to a shabby millionaire.
And the one thing that I thought was kind of interesting is that how it's distinguishable between the two principles is basically shabby millionaire or the true value does not have to do with the responsibility for unexpectable consequences, but for the unexpected cost of expected consequences. So basically, it's not the act in question, which they don't know about. It's the actual consequences of it. Whereas you can kind of differentiate that a little bit with the thin skull, because it's the actual damages to the person that you're not aware of.
I think that's funny that you stand up. You say, I'd like to invoke the thin skull defense as well as the shabby millionaire. You apply both of those to your case, and the jury would be going, what?
Just throw it at the wall, see what sticks.
Because I understand that you have to represent that, and the judge has to give a special instruction on it to the jury.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's how it generally goes, is that, and really the first place whenever you get a new case, and this is what I always do, is whenever I have a new case, I figure out what the different causes of actions are. I go straight to the jury instructions that I want to use, and that's how I start developing the case, because that's what's the charge to the jury. So
right.
You want to basically taper your case around those jury instructions. So that's where you want to start. So,
but I mean, the judge or the jury wouldn't know to consider that as far as the damages unless they're given instructions on how that works.
Exactly.
So
there was an English tort law case, and I thought this was kind of an interesting one. Polemus v. Furness Withy and Company.
Furness Withy?
Yeah. It's 1921. One of the defendant's servants dropped a wooden plank on a ship's hold, which happened to contain cans of benzene that were leaking flammable vapors. The plank caused a spark that ignited the vapors and destroyed the ship. The court held that the plaintiffs were entitled to full judgment and reasoned that the facts that the resulting damage was not the exact kind of damage one would expect is immaterial so long as the damage is in fact directly traceable to the negligent act. In other words, once the act is negligent, the fact that the exact operation was not foreseen is immaterial. So as you said, there is a kind of a debate going on about this because the results can be pretty catastrophic for the defendant.
Yeah, you can stretch it out there to quite a bit.
So there is a current debate over it, as you mentioned. The debate continues today over whether or not the application to the mental and psychological harm, that's kind of a big deal because that's hard to quantify.
Well, it's kind of like throwing in pain and suffering.
Yeah. J. Stanley McQuaid argues in favor of the application and criticized proposals to limit recovery to mental harms that an ordinary person would sustain or harms reactivated or exacerbated when tortfeasors have prior notice of plaintiff's eggshell status. Because psychological trauma is almost always the result of prior predispositioning condition, McQuaid argues that courts should treat mental harms the same way that they treat pre-existing physical conditions. So, basically, it doesn't matter if it's mental or physical. They're already there to begin with, so you got to treat it the same way. Mark Levy and Saul Rosenberg disagree, and they maintain that mental harm should not receive the same treatment as physical harms. They contend that an overbroad eggshell plaintiff rule confuses subsequence with consequence, assigning liability for psychological injuries simply on the basis of causation. In fact, grossly oversimplifies the underlying causes of such injuries. So they use post-traumatic stress disorder as an example, which is kind of interesting. And they say the eggshell plaintiff rule is inadequate to explain the complex constellation of interdependent factors that contribute to actual as well as merely alleged mental damages. They suggest that potential eggshell plaintiffs undergo thorough investigation of their lives prior to and after an injury sustained due to negligent conduct. Such inquiries would produce a far more scientific accurate determination of whether the alleged harms arose from the defendant's conduct or from the plaintiff's pre-existing mental condition.
Well,
so basically what they're doing is they're shifting the burden.
Yeah, I would agree with that to a point, because like when you're talking about the physical damages, you're talking about reimbursing somebody for property damage, medical bills, loss of income, loss of future earnings. Those are things that can be calculated. How do you calculate mental stuff? Oh, man, it's messed me up good. $10 million might make me feel better. I think I'd be sane again if I got $10 million.
Right.
I mean, you know, there's no way to measure that. The others, it's measurable. Now this is unmeasurable. I mean, unless you're just going to say, we're going to give him enough money to go to a psychiatrist for the rest of his life, once a week for the rest of his life, or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, that's what he needs. But, I mean, other than that, how do you measure that?
Well, another interesting application to it would be based upon someone's religious beliefs. So some people argue that basically the rule should not extend to damages that result from a person's religious convictions. For example, refusing blood transfusions and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Others suggest that religious beliefs constitute an integral component of each human being, analogous to pre-existing mental and physical conditions. As such, injuries exacerbated by religious strictures should qualify for additional damages under the eggshell plaintiff rule. So that's even taking it one step further.
Well, that would be bad. If you end up in the hospital and your family's religion is against blood transfusions and you need a blood transfusion, and so you die because you don't get it because of religious reasons, and now the other person's responsible for it.
If I was a defense attorney, I would be jumping up and down on that, saying it's their own fault.
Yeah. So. But according to the eggshell thing there, but that's not a pre-existing condition, your religion. I don't know that you could do that, tie it to religion. Well, just the same way, I read another one where the person suffered some kind of trauma from a car wreck or something like that, and the rest of the family, there's like three others in the family, they all claimed mental problems too because of having to deal with his injuries.
Yeah.
And they said, now wait a minute, this eggshell theory ends at the person, the tortfeasor or yeah. whatever, ends at them. It doesn't extend to the family. The yeah. family can't claim mental loss of mental capacity because he got hurt.
Well, and also there was no actual physical damage to them, too.
Yeah, well, the physical damage was their father or brother or whoever he was
yeah.
getting injured, and they had to have the trauma of that.
Well, I mean, the difference is that you can file a kind of a loss of consortium claim. But that's only for like a husband and wife or married couples.
Yeah, but that doesn't come under the same thing.
No.
That doesn't come under the eggshell theory thing.
No, but it's a way to kind of step outside the actual accident itself to get one yeah. step further.
Yeah, but to me, here they're already thinking of ways. You allow that, you open that door a little bit, and here there's people ready to pile right in.
So here's open the door even more. One person argues that the rule should be extended to victims of pro-eating disorder websites, and to hold those websites liable for exacerbating eating disorders. She notes that other media tort cases have considered psychological state of victims and contends that viewers of pro-eating disorder websites are eggshell victims due to their psychological vulnerabilities. So basically these different kinds of websites that have like, you know, really thin models and do this and whatever, mm-hmm. that's actually going to damage people mentally from looking at those. So that's really taking another step.
Boy, I'll say.
Yeah. So... You know, this is one article I was reading. It's kind of interesting that what they compare it to. They contrast the eggshell plaintiff with tort laws. I'm sorry, they contrast tort laws eggshell plaintiff rule with a fundamental contract theory. And that is unfair surprise. And the basic case that comes from is the Hadley v. Baxendale case. Mm-hmm. I think we talked about that before, where there was I can't remember the exact facts of the case, but essentially... There was a mill, and...
Oh, was that where the barrel rolled out?
No, that's Ray Sipsa.
Oh.
Hadley v. Baxendale is essentially this mill ordered a part, and there was a delay in delivery, and because of the delay in delivery, they lost a lot of money, but it was unforeseeable to the person who was bringing that part that they were going to lose that money from that, so mm-hmm. they couldn't be held liable for the delay in bringing it to them, because that would be unfair surprise, basically. They couldn't foresee that. So
you can't apply the eggshell thing to that.
No. And that's actually a very strict contract law principle
mm-hmm.
that contract damages are recoverable only if they are foreseeable. That foreseeability may come either generally because the loss arises naturally from the defendant's breach of contract, or specially because the special circumstances were communicated by the plaintiffs to the defendants and thus known to both parties. The basic rule in Hadley v. Baxendale is that the victim is often in a better position than the injurer to avoid the consequences of a breach of contract, even if the victim cannot prevent the breach herself. So mm-hmm. the victim may communicate their vulnerability to the breacher, thus putting the breacher on notice of the potential consequential damages, or the victim may take precautions herself to avoid those damages. So it's kind of interesting why that theory in contract law is one way, mm-hmm. and why the theory in tort law is another.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're directly opposite.
Yeah.
And they're almost exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a very interesting argument. One of the problems I have with it is that the eggshell plaintiff rule right now does not consider whether the eggshell victim can take extra precautions to protect themselves from these issues. So basically, mm-hmm. they're not doing anything to keep these from happening. They're not taking any affirmative action or mm-hmm. to notify anybody else of their vulnerabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So the basic theory that would be is that if people were aware of these different eggshell vulnerabilities these people have, they would actually exercise more care around them and it would be more equitable.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you knew somebody had one of these situations, you might do something.
If you knew they had an eggshell skull.
You might do something differently. If you knew the person had an eggshell.
You wouldn't bap them in the head.
You wouldn't bap them in the head.
Yeah.
So
you should make your frailties known. You should wear a sign or something.
Yeah. Right now, eggshell victims have little or no incentive to discover their vulnerabilities and self-protect under the current rule.
That's right. They're trying to cash in on it.
Yeah. So basically, if they're trying to cash in on it, I don't think so. Nobody wants their head bashed in.
I don't want to let anybody know about my disease I have because then I'll be worth more if I get hit.
So a rule that would hold injurers liable only for foreseeable damages would mitigate those problems, and a lot of people think is better than the current rule we have right now. A foreseeability rule better aligns victims' incentives by forcing victims to bear any accident losses that result from unforeseeable vulnerabilities. Eggshell victims would have an incentive to discover their vulnerabilities and self-protect in order to minimize those harms. And also, although injurers would not internalize all the harm they cause under foreseeability rule, such a rule would likely not cause a significant deviation from optimal incentives among injurers. Eggshell plaintiffs are by definition extremely few. There's not a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes it likely that the cost of injurers' misestimation of expected damages exceeds any eggshell harm prevented by the current rule we have right now. So it's very hotly contested rule, as you can see why.
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem fair.
I was reading a case, Schaefer v. Hoffman.
Mm-hmm.
Schaefer was the driving drunk and ran over Hoffman. And Hoffman is a lady, and she had already been being treated for knee problems, back problems. She went to a chiropractor on a regular basis. She'd been getting treatments for her knees because they were degenerating, and she was, you know, she wasn't old, but she was like in her 50s, and her knees had been degenerating some and stuff like that. Well, this guy runs over her. That didn't help her situation any.
No, probably not.
So she had really messed up knees, and she had a disc problem, but she was already being treated for a disc problem. But she'd already been working on getting a disability because of all her problems she was having. So after she gets hit by this car, she has extensive problems and has to go to the chiropractor on a regular basis, has to have surgery done on her knees and all this kind of stuff, and she basically can't work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So she's saying, you know, I want to be compensated for this. And he was like, well, you already had all these problems.
Yeah.
You weren't going to be able to walk much longer anyway. You were already having these problems. You know, I shouldn't have to pay for all that. You were already going to a chiropractor. Why should I have to pay for your chiropractor from now on? You were working on getting a disability. I did you a favor. I ran over you. Now you got your disability, you know? And so it got ruled in her favor the first two times. Then it got overturned and sent back again under the eggshell rule. But it mostly had to do with, this was a case in Minnesota, and Minnesota has some very specific language.
Yeah.
And when the judge gave the instruction to the jury, he gave it to them in the unupdated form. So there was an updated form that instruction was supposed to be given. So it was overturned because of that.
Because the judge gave an improper jury instruction?
Yeah. So, and they said that it could have prejudiced the jury against it.
You know, what's interesting is that usually the parties come with their own jury instructions and they supply the court with them a lot of times.
Really?
So there's probably a pretty strong argument that the person may have waived. At least that's what I would have said. They would have waived their argument on that because you're the one that suggested it.
Well, there was a discussion as to which one they should use.
Oh, there was.
Yeah. And so I'm surprised that they ended up using the wrong one.
Well, there's probably a discussion about it, and the side that lost was arguing for a different one.
Yeah.
And they probably objected to the insertion of the wrong one, and then that's basically their grounds for appeal.
But I was thinking about that, and I was thinking, you know, a practical application to it. It's one thing to read about it, but you think about how would that affect you? And I was thinking, like, if, say, I'm walking through a parking lot and some guy backs up in his car without looking and hits me in the legs. Now, maybe the normal person, they might be hurt a little bit. Maybe they just hop back up. Maybe they get hurt and need arthroscopic surgery because they get a little meniscus tear or something like that. But for me, I get hit. I've got knee replacements. It could buckle those completely to where I've got to go in and have knee replacement surgery all over again, which would be far more expensive than just arthroscopic or something like that, or a, maybe a physical therapy or something.
Yeah.
I'd have to go to that. Well, they wouldn't have any way of knowing I have knee replacements or not.
That's true.
So, but I mean, there's nothing I could do to protect myself or do anything or walk around with a sign on knee replacements. Do not hit, you know, don't knock me down.
I think we need to make you a sign.
Yeah. I wear like a neon flashing sign on my hat or something like that.
One interesting, kind of way to, juxtapose the eggshell skull theory is the steel skull corollary. So basically a steel skull is somebody who has, they suffer relatively minor injuries compared
to a hard head.
Yeah, compared to the average victim. They have like stronger bones and or whatnot. And
like so, Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
In Unbreakable. Unbreakable, yeah.
So basically, if you want to have the eggshell theory, then you should also have the steel skull theory, which basically, well, I didn't really get hurt that bad, but that's because I got a strong head.
Yeah, you're just lucky.
The average person would have suffered this much, so you have to pay me this much because that's what the average person would have suffered. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, you can make the argument for the steel skull.
Sure.
If you're going to apply the eggshell, then yeah, the steel skull. So
I was just extremely athletic and I dove out of the car and rolled, did front rolls over and sprung a cartwheel and landed on my feet.
Yeah. So you, I mean, basically if you cause some sort of accident, then you would have to pay foreseeable rather than actual damages with steel skull victims. So it doesn't seem very fair there, does it?
Well, I don't know. I might agree with that. I mean, you know, it's because it, to me, it follows the same thing as attempted murder. I don't believe there should be attempted murder. You shoot some son of a bitch five times and he doesn't die. You shouldn't just get assault out of it or whatever. You should get murder charge. I don't care if he lived. Your intent was to kill him and you followed through. You didn't just think about it. You didn't shoot in his general direction. You shot him five times.
Yeah.
You had complete intent. Just because this poor bastard lived, that doesn't mean you should get off it with any less.
I kind of see where you're going with that.
I mean, that's the same thing as what you're saying, but in criminal law as opposed to tort law.
Yeah.
There was one other case, doesn't follow that exactly, but it kind of goes along with it. This had to do with a drunken driver crossed the center line and caused a collision, and the plaintiff sued the manufacturer of her Lexus because the person that was injured in the passenger seat, they said the passenger compartment was not made strong enough to withstand the impact. Mm-hmm. So they were suing the manufacturer, Toyota, the manufacturer of Lexus, because of this. So when they got to court, Toyota has this expert witness that comes up and says, basically, the reason that person was hurt wasn't because the car is unsafe, but because the passenger was too fat. She said that she was
actually said that's how they said it.
Yeah, they said she was 5'8" tall and weighed 239 pounds, and then she started getting into the physics of how seatbelts work.
Yeah.
So if you're fairly thin and you put that seatbelt across you, that seatbelt is across your pelvis bone,
right,
and your shoulder bone. If you're extremely obese, you've got maybe a foot of soft body mass between your belt and your bone, which when you're on an impact, you're going to go all the way to bone before that belt stops you. So you're going to be moving more. So they said that the obese person sitting in the seat is going to have a higher ratio of movement in a car than a person that's not fat. So they're saying that that was the reason they were hurt. Well, then they turned around and tried to imply the eggshell theory, right, that, hey, you take the victim the way they are. Just because they're fat doesn't mean you can hurt them.
Yeah.
So, you know, they were arguing that. But what it finally came down to is they couldn't prove that the Lexus passenger compartment was unsafe, that there was anything negligent in the way it was built.
Right.
You know, the negligence, if anything, was the drunk driver. But evidently, maybe he didn't have insurance, and he didn't have any money, and they couldn't get anything from him, so they went after the manufacturer of the car.
Well, that's the one thing. If you want to invoke the eggshell theory, you have to first have negligence. If you don't have the negligence,
right,
it doesn't matter.
Right. So they were trying to prove negligence in the way the car was built.
Yeah.
And they couldn't prove that. Yeah. So it didn't matter about the eggshell theory because,
yeah,
you know, it didn't matter. That threw it out. But I thought that was... Well, it's too bad. It's because the person was overweight.
So that probably didn't even make it to the jury then.
I don't know. Who would make the decision? They just said they didn't find negligence. You're right. It may have been just the judge in there.
Yeah, so. Threw it out in summary judgment or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't even see any negligence here.
Yeah. I mean, and you think of Lexus as being one of the better built cars, you know?
Yeah, I totaled one.
Yeah? You totaled a Lexus?
I did.
Hmm.
I ran into a tree.
Well, that tree is ought to give you the eggshell theory thing there.
I was a steel skull.
Well, my brother ran a Pinto into a tree.
That's true.
They didn't have any kind. It's a wonder. It's a good thing he ran into it forwards, not backwards.
Exactly.
I wouldn't have a brother.
Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
So Legal Briefs is the part of the show where I ask Tommy different legal theories and questions we talked about. This one's got a bunch of them, so this one's probably going to be the longest legal briefs ever.
But they're going to be so overlapping, I won't remember which one's which.
What is a steel skull?
Steel skull means that you should have gotten messed up worse than you did in the wreck, but for whatever reason, you came out of it pretty good, but you want to get paid for like you really got messed up.
Right.
Just because you were lucky enough to come out of it okay.
You want to get foreseeable damages, not actual damages.
Right.
Which... is kind of hand in hand a little bit with the eggshell theory. So what is an eggshell plaintiff?
Eggshell plaintiff means you may have underlying conditions or diseases or whatever that get triggered because as a result of, or are worse as a result of the damages that you incur, and the defendant has to pay for those too.
That's
it
right.
Doesn't, it's not an exception just because it was pre-existing.
Now, are these, eggshell vulnerabilities, are they patent or latent?
Both.
That's true. They could be, I guess.
Yeah, they could be either one.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But latent being more likely.
Yeah, that you don't know that they're there, or you don't know that they're, at least the person assaulting you or whatever doesn't know you're there, the person neglecting you.
And what is the case of Hadley v. Baxendale?
Hadley v. Baxendale? Was that the one where the...
Hadley v. Baxendale is the contract law case where the person being sued is not liable for unforeseeable damages as from a breach of contract.
Oh.
Because they didn't
know.
Oh,
yeah. That was the part being delivered.
Yeah. So basically, it's the exact opposite theory in contract law of the eggshell plaintiff rule.
Mm-hmm.
So why they're different, I don't know. And lastly, I think you mentioned the word tortfeasor.
Mm-hmm.
So what, since you used the word, what is a tortfeasor?
Well, they kept mentioning it in there. It sounds like something you'd find at a strip bar or something, but.
Now on the center stage, tortfeasor.
But a tortfeasor is a person, I guess it's the person that has been damaged.
Flip that around.
Oh, it's the person that did the damaging.
There you go.
Okay. I knew it was one or the other, but it was hard to follow. A lot of those kept talking about the tortfeasor, and I thought, could we please not use the word tortfeasor?
Yeah, that's what I thought you said, so that's why I wanted to clarify that. So.
Yeah, I didn't know what I was reading.
Yeah. Well, there you go. So I'm going to go have some scrambled eggs for dinner.
Yeah, I guess so. Just don't break them all at once. And, you know, I forgot the one really big update that we didn't mention at the start of the show that we should have.
What's that?
Making a murderer.
Oh, yeah.
They have a guy in prison for murder in Wisconsin that has confessed to the killing of that Terry Halbach that Stephen Avery was convicted on the second time.
Right.
And they made the follow-up about it, and he insisted, and they forced Brandon Dassey into one of the worst coerced confessions I've ever seen, and can't believe that anybody with a law degree could look at that and say, yeah, that's a good confession.
I know.
But they've got a guy that says that he did it. Now they're trying to prove the veracity, or what does he know? I guess he'd have to have some kind of details that only he would know.
Well, yeah, he's kind of like a jailhouse snitch, but he's snitching on himself.
Yeah. But, I mean, what motivation does he have? I mean, other than maybe he's already in prison and he's going to serve the rest of his life and he doesn't care.
Yeah.
And so he did it. But, you know, there was all kinds of things that they asked about. There was a policeman. You know, that was in Wisconsin as well.
Yeah.
And there was a policeman that called in finding a car
right
in the woods. And then they said, what about that? Oh, that didn't happen.
Right.
Well, what do you mean it didn't happen? How do we know that that was done if it didn't happen?
And then they went to search for the car and they found it
there in the lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it hadn't been there. They had searched a lot before, and they had somebody that they said had just joined the group, and they said, why don't you go here, and why don't you walk in and walk right down there and check that line of cars?
Yeah.
And she walked in and walked right to it like 5 minutes after she started the search upon her instructions of where to go.
Super fishy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there was a lot of things like that. They couldn't find the keys or something like that, and then the police group that was supposed to stay clear of it because they were already under question, they go in and search and they find the keys.
Yeah.
You know, so when they show up, there's a lot of stuff that really looked bad there. But here is this guy, even if he ends up getting acquitted, he has spent his entire life in prison wrongly on two separate charges. Now, one of them, at least they just screwed up and did it. But this second one, it just looks intentional because he had that big lawsuit against him.
It does.
And this was a way to get out of it.
It does. It'll be interesting to see what comes of that. They didn't disclose who the guy was, though. I think they're keeping it secret for now.
Yeah.
So they can kind of investigate it further.
Yeah.
Because basically the confession came to the people who were doing the documentary. They're the ones that this guy came out to. So I think they were turning it over to the authorities, hopefully the proper authorities, to determine what took place.
Yeah. But that is something else. If that's the way that ends up, I don't even know what to think.
It's crazy.
There ought to be some eggshell damages out of that. I'll tell you that. There ought to be some eggshell heads cracked because of that. Mix it up and make some dough.
A little bit of flour. Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable Podcast for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out, though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Hello, welcome to Tommy's Random Thoughts. Today's random thought is eating crabs and lobsters. Now, I really like eating crab, and I love eating lobster. They're both just delicious. But what I can't fathom, any way I think about it, is who was the guy that first figured out that you could eat those things? I mean, if you look at a crab or you look at a lobster, the last thing that you think of is, that'd be good. I'm going to dip that sucker in butter and eat him whole. You just don't get that impression when you look at them. They've got pinchers and everything, and they're angry looking. They're always angry looking. No matter if they're happy crabs or lobsters, they're angry looking. But somebody pulled one of those out of the water and looked at it, or had it hanging off their finger, pinching on them, and they said, you know what? I'll bet that thing would be good eating. I can't imagine what type of outside-of-the-box thinking that took. This guy, though, should be crowned as a hero, whoever he is. He should have gone down in history. The guy that figured out you can eat crabs and lobsters. But it just boggles my mind when I look at them now. And you see them climbing over each other in the tank when you go to Red Lobster. And you say, nope, they don't look good, but they do taste good. I'm just going to close my eyes and eat them. So my hat goes off to the guy that first thought of eating those things. This has been Tommy's Random Thoughts.